It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office released a report that says the White House broke the law when it withheld aid from Ukraine. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, our next guest has been called the Korean Julia Child by the New York Times, and her followers call her their Korean mom. Her internet and cooking world fame comes largely in part from her YouTube channel with over 4 million subscribers, where she posts videos explaining step-by-step how to make all different kinds of Korean foods, including these cinnamon cookies filled with white bean paste.
Hi, everybody. Today, let's make something sweet. In Korean, gaepi manju. Manju is some cookies inside filled with sweet beans. Really delicious. I'm going to show you. This is a small, cute cookie. You guys can follow my step-by-step directions, and then you'll make this manju from now on.
Mang Chi is our Food Friday guest. She was born and raised in South Korea, where she learned the fundamentals of home cooking with her mom. She works out of New York City now. Her website is mangchi.com. That's M-A-A-N-G-C-H-I.com. Her new cookbook is called Mang Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, from everyday meals to celebration cuisine. Mang Chi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
How did you get started making these YouTube cooking videos, Mang Chi?
I was sharing my recipes, and I thought that it would be fun if anybody who is interested in my recipes, and then I want to share. So because entire my life so far, just food is always important in my life. And everybody tastes my food, and it's delicious, they said. So just on YouTube, started, you know, in the early time, around 13 years ago, I started. And once I posted my video, and everybody loved that. And I was so happy, excited, and then I just kept going on so far.
And I got to say, I think part of why people like it, Mang Chi, is you make it look really fun. Cooking is, you really get a lot of joy and fun out of cooking, don't you?
Yeah, you like cooking?
I do. I like to cook, but I don't think I have as much as fun as you do.
Cooking is fun. And you know, while you are cooking, this is making for yourself and for your family, your loved ones. Why you are not excited, you know? So whenever I cook, and every three meals, I'm so excited about my next meal. So everything should be delicious and clean and healthy. Sometimes not healthy, but once in a while, it's okay.
And a lot of your recipes, Mang Chi, are also easy. You take it step by step, and you try to keep it simple. Some are more complicated, but you really focus on things we can do at home, right?
Yeah. I just work hard. How can I make this simple? And people who follow my recipe, they don't know anything about Korean food. And how can they follow my direction, you know, so step by step, so easily? And then actually, I just plan a lot. And then just that's it. And also, I always, I don't like a complicated process, whatever I do. But cooking, when I do my cooking, even just before I started YouTube, I always want to make a simple and delicious food without losing any authenticity.
Korean food has gotten more popular in the United States in the last few years. What is it that makes Korean food special?
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about Korean food, but I got to say a lot of it is new to me, going through your cookbook, for example.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'm surrounded by people who love Korean food already. So it sounds like Korean food is a trend. But recently I traveled to Mexico and I met some people from, they are from Texas. And they don't know anything about even kimchi. So, you know, see, still, you know, not many people know about Korean food. But as you said, you know, in a few years, it is kind of a trend, you know, Korean, including Korean pop, you know, also, you know, Korean drama, and it's Korean food too. So New York Times always talk about Korean restaurant, you know, that means that, you know, Korean food gets some interest. Yeah. And when I studied, actually, you know, not many people knew about even kimchi. But as we talk about this, many people are interested in Korean drama. In the drama, they see that a lot of, you know, their favorite actor, actress, they eating some kind of, you know, spicy food, and then they are checking out, okay, what is it about? And then they found my recipe, and they follow my, you know, directions. And also, you know, some kind of, you know, the people, I think definitely it's from online. Online is make it possible. So especially this YouTube is also online, and also through online, like, you know, taco truck, you know, the California, you know, the roiche, and the taco truck, you know, Korean style and Mexican kind of a cuisine, you know, mixed. So it's all this is through the online, I think it's getting popular.
Mong Chi is with us for Food Friday. You can watch her online. Her website is mongchi.com. That's MAANGCHI.com. She's got a very popular YouTube channel on Korean cooking. We're talking about her new book. It's Mong Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. Mong Chi, you just mentioned kimchi. That's something I like a lot these days. I grew up with some Polish cooking, so we had sauerkraut. So it's a similar idea, that fermented cabbage. Tell us about kimchi and what makes that special.
So actually, you know, one of my readers, he also makes a sauerkraut. And then he says that, okay, kimchi is so similar to a sauerkraut. And then makes kimchi on a regular basis with their friends at home. And kimchi is, you know, fermented food, but actually when you eat, it doesn't have to be fermented. I love freshly made kimchi, and it's a kind of a salad, Korean salad, but you can keep in the refrigerator for a long time. So sometimes aged kimchi, so you can age years. And, you know, and when you add a lot of salt, and then it's going to be the, you know, fermentation process is going to slow down. So that kimchi has all nutrients inside, and vegetable, plus I use, you know, fish sauce, and also fermented fish, and also sometimes I add some shrimp there, and kind of, you know, we prepare the kimchi, it's just this is a sauce staple, that we always, Korean, every family has you know, their different, little bit different recipes, and they focus on how to make delicious, you know, kimchi. So that's why kimchi is very, very important.
You shared some recipes with us. There's one with kimchi in it. People can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. You have a kimchi stew. What else goes into a kimchi stew along with the kimchi?
What else? Kimchi. Kimchi, you know, first to make a kimchi stew delicious one, and then you need to ferment. Fermented kimchi means that it tastes sour. So you chop it up, kimchi, and then put it on the pot or any pan. And then I needed some protein. So I use sometimes, you know, a can of tuna or sometimes, you know, pork belly. So pork belly with a little fat, and then also onion and a little bit Korean hot pepper paste, and mix together, and I add some stock. It should be delicious. And then you just boil this, and then really, like, it tastes like sweet and a little bit sour. And also, we call this kimchi, also, it's a little crispy, even though it's cooked. So I have met many people. Some people don't like kimchi smell, but I never met anybody who doesn't like kimchi stew. Because when it's cooked, the texture is changing, and also really, really kind of a complexity of the, you know, the taste, the flavor is enjoying. Everybody enjoy this kimchi jjigae, kimchi stew.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Mong Chi. She teaches Korean cooking to her millions of YouTube followers and posts recipes at mongchi.com. Her new cookbook is called Mong Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you tried some Korean cooking? Did you grow up with Korean cooking? What is your favorite dish to cook? Have you watched Mong Chi's YouTube channel? Do you have a favorite recipe that you might have learned from her? You can call in and thank her for sharing that with you if you'd like. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, And we've got some recipes Mong Chi sent along from her book. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday, a great way to get yourself started. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Mong Chi. She's the internet's Korean mom with her easy-to-follow YouTube cooking videos. She's talking to us about her new cookbook. It's called Mong Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, from Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried different kinds of Korean foods? Are they the foods you grew up with? Do you have a favorite dish? Have you tried something, maybe at a restaurant, a food stand of some sort, and you'd like to find out how to make it? Have you traveled to Korea? Was there a favorite food you had while you were there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got some recipes as well that she shared with us. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to talk about not a recipe, but I love this concept, Mong Chi, the Korean lunchboxes. Could you tell us about the concept and how these come together?
Yes. Korean lunchbox is called the doshirak. So doshirak, I just made my doshirak for my family for a long time. So it's like, you know, and the doshirak is that all the housewives get together. My friends, you know, whenever we meet, we talk about what are you going to make these days, doshirak side dish, doshirak banchan. So banchan, side dishes are very important because my loved ones will eat this. So doshirak is, I made this one chapter, total whole chapter is for my doshirak chapter. When my editor asked me to make a new book, I said that I can make, one book, total whole one book for doshirak, Korean lunchbox. And then, but she wanted to make them more. So this is my, second book. And then it is one chapter is my totally like a doshirak. So doshirak is, Korean meal is rice and side dishes. Rice is, we use short grain rice. And this rice is kind of a little stickier than long grain rice, and also blend. So we need some kind of a salty stuff. So that's kind of a mom or like anybody who makes a lunchbox, Korean doshirak. And then we need to think about a well-balanced diet. A carb is rice, and sometimes I make that, the multigrain rice. Multigrain rice recipe is also in my book. And then, what kind of, protein can I use? Okay, I'm going to use in a fish fillet, or sometimes, some tuna pancake, or sometimes, beef, salty beef. And I need also vegetables, some kind of for the vitamins. And then I just choose that some sliced cucumber and sauté. So everything is easy. And also some side dishes are, this side dish we call this mit banchan. If you make this and then keep in the containers, you can keep in the refrigerator 1 week or even until 1 month. So this kind of mit banchan is anytime you can just take it out from the refrigerator, just you can eat with rice. It can be one meal, but Korean mom cannot give that, wrap this rice, rice and mit banchan only. So I have to make a freshly cooked something. So that's kind of, I usually make a kind of protein. Sometimes roll the egg in a kind of omelet style, and sometimes, tuna pancake. And then I just make the mix and match, and also colorful. Color should be, everything should look really nice and appetizing, and also kimchi. Kimchi is a kind of pungent smell, so I always find the small container and then put it in the kimchi, right? And then eating between the, some kind of a dried food and rice, and then you feel like a kimchi, so eating in the middle, like between the rice and other side dishes. So I was always focusing on what to wrap for my children, That's kind of my whole interest in life when they grow up, yeah.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ellen is with us in Delavan. Ellen, hi.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to call in and tell Mong Chi that I'm so grateful for her books. I have both books, My son spent 3 years in Korea in the service, and he came home in love with the Korean food. And so I tried to learn to cook it. And thanks to your books, he says my food is better now, my Korean food. So.
And Ellen, do you watch, have you worked from her videos too?
Oh, yes, yes. You're my favorite, one of my favorite YouTubers. I sit and watch you in, what do you call that, binge watch Monkey.
Yeah.
Ellen,
you
thanks
are
so
one
much.
Of them.
Yeah, you've got a lot of fans, Monkey. Do you run into people as you're out and about who recognize you from the YouTube videos?
All the time. Whenever I go, you know, even I'm living in Manhattan in the center, so whenever I walk around, then the people just say, oh, Monkey! Even the not you know, only in Manhattan. Just I go to even last time Nice in France, and then there was a dark night. And then I just walk, and then somebody coming out of the hair salon, and then, oh, Monkey! And then I was so shocked, because there was darkness. So she was following me, my recipes. Wherever I go, I meet my readers. So anyway, you pronounce my name, Monkey, so nicely that I know that you are good at cooking.
She did great. Yeah, that was wonderful. Well, I wanted to check out another recipe now. And you mentioned these in your lunchboxes, the tuna pancakes,
yeah.
And they look fantastic. You used canned tuna. Tell us about these pancakes.
Yeah, the reason I kind of introduce you to my tuna pancake is that for your audience who never learned any Korean cooking, you don't need any specific Korean ingredients. You have a can of tuna, then you can make it right now. So easy. Just drain can of tuna and then just mix with just one egg and also, you know, a little bit chopped onion, green onion and garlic. And we need some kind of a glue-like things, and the flour or rice flour, and mix it together, salt and pepper. And pan fry in the, like, so you are in a skillet, and just in 3 minutes, kind of a golden brown, and this is absolutely delicious. And because I added some chopped onion, it's kind of juicy. So, you know, just a few months ago, my daughter is an already grown-up adult. And she said, I asked her, what kind of side dish do you like still think about I used to make for you? She said, tuna pancake in Korean champijeon, because she really liked it. And also, when I worked in Canada, I work for non-profit organization, and mostly my coworkers are Koreans. And then I made a tuna pancake, and those guys, even Koreans, they love that. So I just even like this, and I explained to them, they made right next day. So I just, for your audience, this is like, you know, the Korean dish, but you guys can make it so easily at home.
We have that at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're talking to Monkey. Her new book is Monkey's Big Book of Korean Cooking, from Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. Back to your calls now. Melanie is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Melanie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Monkey, komsamnida for your cookbook.
Oh, thank you very much. You said thank you very much in Korean. Awesome.
I did. I've been stationed overseas, and I spent a bit of time in Seoul here and there. And first of all, I have a crazy craving for kimchi all the time. I'm from German ancestry, so sauerkraut. So I love the fermented cabbage that all the different cultures have.
Mm-hmm.
I almost ate too much Korean barbecue when I was in Seoul because it's just so delicious with the leaves and everything that you wrap around, you know, just to make your own little wrap. And then bibimbap, yeah, so the Korean food is just so delicious with all the varieties and the spice and everything. So I just love your food, and I wish people from central Wisconsin, where I'm from, had more of an opportunity to taste it, because it really is so delicious.
It sounds like you are already a Korean food expert.
That's definitely, yeah. Thanks for
yes.
that call, Melanie. Now, two people have mentioned the service, U.S. service in Korea. You actually have a recipe called Monkey Army Base Stew. Can you
yeah.
tell us about that?
Yes, yes. Army Base Stew is that just, you know, it looks like a junk food, because we add kimchi plus all kind of, you know, sausage inside and canned corn. and also even rice cake there, and everything inside, and just about, it turned out so delicious. That was not my favorite because of the ingredients, all kind of ingredients, kind of it doesn't look like go well together, but a lot of Koreans love that. So I made this, and these days I like it. Yeah, that's in Korean War, after Korean War 1950s, and then kind of in Korea, you know, kimchi stew, kimchi soup is always existed, you know, among Koreans. But around that time, the American soldiers, they just brought that all canned food, ham, sausage, these things. So it's going into Korean community. Hmm. And then somebody invented the kind of, you know, recipe. Okay, this kimchi stew, I can add this in a sausage or ham. And then they make it so nicely. So that's why, like, that's called this, it's called that, like, American kind of, you know, the station, that area, it's called Dongducheon. Dongducheon is a Gyeonggi province near Seoul. And that kind of food was just invented around there. So this is an army-based stew. It's an army, because there is a there is an army base. So that's why still a lot of people love that army base stew.
Well, Mongchi, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Me too. Thank you.
That was Mongchi with us on Food Friday. She was born and raised in South Korea. Her cooking video channel on YouTube has over 4 million followers. Her website is mongchi.com. That's MAANGCHI.com. She talked to us about her new cookbook. It's called Mongchi's Big Book of Korean Cooking. You can find a couple of the recipes we talked about and a couple more that we didn't. Kimchi stew is among them. Those tuna pancakes as well, and a couple others. They're all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Some great recipes for a cold and snowy weekend. The Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office released a report yesterday that found the Trump administration broke federal law when it withheld military aid to Ukraine. The report highlights a crucial issue at the heart of the impeachment proceedings facing President Trump and arguments over how the White House and Congress handle issues like foreign aid. Our next guest joins us to talk about the impact of the report and what it could mean for the president. Ayesha Roscoe is the White House reporter for National Public Radio. Ayesha, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about this law that the Government Accountability Office says was broken here by the White House. What is it?
So this is the Impoundment Control Act. And what this law does is it really lays out something that is in the Constitution. So in the Constitution, Congress has the power of the purse. And so that means they control the spending. But Congress can at times delegate some of that authority. You see some of that with trade. If they pass a law or pass certain measures, they can delegate some of that authority to the president. But in this case, what Congress was doing was really specifying that only in very kind of strict, under very strict circumstances, can the president withhold funding that has been appropriated by Congress and signed by a president into law. Because once an appropriations bill is signed into law, it is a law. And so that is what the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is saying that the Trump administration violated when they held up funds that were appropriated and signed into law by President Trump to go to Ukraine.
What justification have we heard from the Trump administration about why they delayed this aid to Ukraine and how they would say it would be consistent with this impoundment law?
So what they say is, and I will say that from testimony that we heard in the House impeachment hearings and other reporting, the reasons for why this money has been held up, we have received different reasons for why this money was held up. So one of the things that they will say is that the president was concerned about corruption in Ukraine, and the idea that there was a new administration in Ukraine, and that the president was concerned about the way this money would be used, that it could be used to further corruption. Then there's also, the president has also said that he was concerned that other countries, European allies, were not kicking in the same amount of funding as the U.S. or not kicking in military funding. And so that was a concern for the president. And what the Office of Management and Budget said, this is the office in the White House that carries out these sorts of orders and kind of doling out the money. What they said in their letter to the GAO was that this money was put on hold pending a policy decision. But they say that this is what they called a programmatic delay, and that this did not rise to the level of them actually withholding the money or like impounding the money. So they were saying they didn't violate the law. They were saying that the White House needed to review the policy behind this funding to make sure that it aligned with the president's foreign policies, and that they were just holding it up for that.
And I have this right from your reporting. Actually, the Government Accountability Office says, well, no, you can't hold stuff up for policy reasons under this Empowerment Act. Am I getting that right?
Yes. I mean, that's the GAO, and this was an 8-page report. So the GAO makes decisions like this on whether things are empowerment or not. And some of these can be very complex, complicated discussions. But this was really very straightforward. And what the GAO said was just plain no, this is not a programmatic delay. They said that would be something where some external factor happened and the money just couldn't be, you know, sent out. They said this is not that. And the president cannot, at the point after something is already law, decide that he wants to go back and revisit whether he wants to spend this money or not. If the president does that, then they have to go to Congress officially and go through official steps and work through what the law requires if the president wants to do that. Because at this point, what people will say and experts that I talk to say, the point for the president to be concerned about policy is before he signs the appropriations law. He could say, I don't know if I want to give this money to Ukraine, or he could say, I want more restrictions on it. But after the president has already signed it, and this is what GAO said, it's the law, like any other law that has to be followed.
Aisha Roscoe is with us, White House reporter for National Public Radio, looking at a ruling from the Government Accountability Office saying the White House violated the law when it delayed money intended to go to Ukraine. Usually, I think, Aisha, a GAO ruling on the empowerment law wouldn't be a top headline story, except it's about the issue that's at the center of the impeachment hearings. How have both parties been talking about this GAO report now that we're on the way to the Senate trial?
Well, that's really what makes this something that is interesting, and what people are focused on is because violating this Empowerment Control Act, it's not a criminal act. Like no one is going to jail over this. But this is this decision to hold up the money is at the center of these impeachment proceedings. And so what Democrats are saying is that you have the GAO, which is nonpartisan, an independent body that has looked at this matter, and they say that the law was broken. And so I talked to Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat from Maryland, and what he said was he was the senator who requested this information from or requested this decision from GAO. And he said that the decision the conclusion that GAO reached really backs up the impeachment proceedings, and that the House impeachment managers who will be making the case for the president's removal will be able to point to this decision made by an independent body that the president broke the law when he pushed for this decision to hold these funds.
Have we heard anything from Republicans in the Senate or the House, for that matter, about this GAO ruling in particular?
So what Republicans are saying is pretty much in line with what the White House is saying. And the White House is rejecting these findings out of hand. And they say that they didn't break the law. And so what the Republican leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, what he said yesterday was that he believes that the president was concerned about corruption in Ukraine and that he had every right to hold the money. And then you have others who are just saying, look, this is just a civil matter. It's not a criminal offense. and basically downplaying the idea that this is a big decision. And then some are accusing the GAO of being partisan or somehow wanting to just go against the president. I should point out that the GAO, it is nonpartisan, and that the GAO has issued decisions that presidents of all parties have disagreed with or issued findings that are not in the favor of prior presidents, President Obama and President Bush and others. So they're kind of equal opportunity when they're making these calls on whether the presidents have stuck with the law.
We've heard from some Republicans saying, really, you're going to drop this thing days before the Senate really kicks into high gear on this trial? Has the GAO talked about the timing here?
The GAO hasn't talked about that. Now, they did get this request from Senator Van Hollen, and so they were working on that. They did say in their report that they were trying to get documents from the Trump administration, from the Defense Department, from the State Department, and that the administration hasn't been completely forthcoming, and that, for instance, the Defense Department has not responded to their request for information, and that the State Department has not responded to some of their requests for information. So they say that they're still seeking this, that they're still seeking more information from the administration about other funds for Ukraine that might have been held up. And they say that they're going to continue pursuing the matter. So this isn't even really over at this point.
A lot more to watch for. Aisha, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Aisha Roscoe is the White House reporter for NPR. She joined us to talk about the Government Accountability Office report that found the Trump administration violated federal law when it withheld aid to Ukraine last summer. If you want help imagining the classroom of the future, look no further than Madison College. The school just wrapped up their first ever virtual reality class. It's a 12-week-long course. Students learned about how VR technology could change fields like marketing and education, along with other technology issues. For part of the course, the actual lectures were held in a virtual reality classroom. Steve Knoll is a professor of marketing at Madison College. He was the instructor of that class. Steve, welcome back.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Where did this idea come from to have a virtual reality class?
Well, our school has always been very progressive with technology. We were one of the first colleges to ever have a social media class 10 years ago. So we've always been kind of looking at futurism and, you know, especially when you think about like jobs, like, you know, for students, where are jobs going to be? Not necessarily today, but where are they going to be in 5 years? So we started looking at VR a couple of years ago and even, you know, brought in some VR headsets into some existing classes. And students really enjoyed it and had lots of questions, and it just kind of rolled from there.
And you're trying to not just have fun with these things. Your goal here, it sounds like, is to let people understand how they can use this stuff in a practical, maybe a job setting.
Correct. Yes. When we started researching this, you know, we're looking at, like, what other schools are using this, especially for, like, distance learning, because that's always an issue, you know, is geography. And that's one of the things about social media is that it takes geography out of the equation. So we started looking around and going, well, how are schools, you know, using this for distance learning? And they really weren't. A lot of schools are using virtual reality within an existing class to do like a VR project. But what we really wanted to try out with this idea of could you recreate an in-class experience digitally? So that's what we did with this new class.
You didn't go on virtual reality on day one, it sounds like. It was a process for everybody to learn how to use this stuff, first of all. Walk us through how this progressed.
Well, the class is called Digital Innovations. It's a 12-week class, and about a third of the class is devoted to VR. But we also cover things like artificial intelligence, chatbots, cryptocurrencies, you know, things like that. But we do this, and we put the VR section kind of towards the end of the class, and we check the headsets out to the students before that, when we're actually spending a few weeks in advance talking about what is VR, what is augmented reality, what is mixed reality. And it gives the students a chance to kind of get used to the technology. And then we do an in-class dry run where everyone actually puts on the headsets. I create a virtual room. We all join. Everything works fine. And then we just cross our fingers that when we actually send the headsets home that they can, you know, get hooked up on their Wi-Fi and go from there. And,
well,
It worked out well.
We'll get to that virtual full-on experience in a bit. But for people who have never done this, they've never tried on a pair of these. I think I've only done this once in my life, and it was some older technology.
Sure.
Tell us what it's like. What does it feel like? What are you physically doing?
Well, a lot of people who have experienced VR these days have been doing it using, like, taking their phone and inserting their phone into, like a almost like a headset, like the old ViewMaster type thing. And you can, like, you know, make it look like you're on a roller coaster or something. And that it's kind of fun. It's kind of cool. But you don't get the immersion where you're actually walking around and interacting with objects. And, you know, the new headsets, the ones that are out now through, we're using Oculus headsets. They, you know, they give you, like, hand controllers. And then, the you know, you have the headset on, you materialize basically in a room. And then depending on what the interface is, it could be a game, it could be a lecture hall, you know, it really depends. It allows people to move in a three-dimensional space. So in the class setting, I can literally say, okay, you three people go stand in that corner and talk about this topic, you three go over here and talk about this topic, and they can physically move away and, you know, their voices will trail off as if you are in real space. And then, you know, they can all talk and then we can all gather back in the middle and kind of debrief each other. This is why I think, you know, a lot of people look at things like Skype as like a distance tool. And a lot of people will use Skype for like a virtual meeting or something like that. But you don't really have that three-dimensional real space experience that VR allows you. And that was one of my big things is would the students feel like they were in our actual classroom. And that was part of the paper they had to write afterwards was compare, you know, you've been, you know, hanging out with the students for, you know, 6 weeks, 7 weeks by this point. You've gotten to know each other in class. Now that we're going to move into a virtual setting, does it feel like you're still in the same room with the same people? And they all were very pleasantly surprised that it still felt like the regular traditional classroom.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College about a class he taught in the last term, teaching about, among other things, virtual reality and ultimately using virtual reality to create a virtual classroom for students by the end of the semester. Talk more about the response from students. It sounds like it felt like being in a classroom.
Yeah, it did. It did. In fact, I had to chuckle. The one negative response I got was the room that I created, you know, because it was virtually, I set it in space. So we were in like an actual, almost like a business room, but there were big windows and outside the windows was, you know, nebulas and stars and all that. And one of the students actually had said that he kept getting distracted from my lecture.
Whoops.
Because he kept looking out the window at this beautiful nebula. And the funny thing is, if he had told me that in class, I literally could have flipped one switch and turned the nebula off. So they liked, I mean, it was a really good experience. You know, we did it once. When we do the class again this spring, we're going to expand it out and we're going to do a couple classrooms in the VR space because that's going to allow us to do more than just a lecture and move on to do more activities based within the VR environment.
Now, one maybe practical question here. If you, Steve, and I are in a virtual reality classroom, I look at you, what do I see? You look at me, what do you see?
Well, and this is the thing is you have to create an avatar. So we are seeing basically, you know, video game cartoon character representations of each other, you know, and that's just a limit of the technology where we're at in 2020. You know, you look at like Hollywood movies about VR and everything is photorealistic. Everything looks, you know, exactly like a real person. You know, the technology is just not there for a real time experience. You know, you can customize it. That's one of the things that I do in the pre-work is students have to create their avatar. And then, you know, there's kind of some, you know, set clothing options and hair color and skin color options.
Just like making your video game character
exactly,
when you start a computer
exactly.
game.
Exactly. So I do ask them to try to create an avatar that roughly approximates what they look like. And the students had fun with it. You know, they were able to represent themselves, but also show some personality. And that was one of the things they really enjoyed in the pre-work before we actually went in and did the class.
Having done this now, what do you see as some of the potential, first in educational settings for using virtual reality?
Well, and you know, a lot of people take an online class. We teach online classes, of course. And, you know, one of the only negatives of that is that lack of real-time, real interaction. And certainly, you can use other things like Skype or Zoom meetings or something like that, but it's still more of a flat, two-dimensional view. VR kind of combines it. It gives you the distance learning capability. Literally, I could be teaching somebody in Idaho and somebody in Florida and someone in Wisconsin. When I did the VR class, I was actually at my house. So I was using my own VR headset. You know, I have my own system at home that's plugged right into the internet, good, strong connection. And the students were all scattered. Some were at their apartment. One of them was in our library, had checked out a private room in the library of the school. So it really takes geography out of it, but it still creates this real-time, real-life scenario where we can have live question and answering, and it's a lot more human to have spatial interactions. You know, that's the thing that a lot of the students, you know, that was a word that they used a lot in their papers, was they found the experience to be a lot more human than they were expecting.
Interesting.
You know, even though we're cartoon characters, basically, it still felt like a real-life, in-person interaction. And I think there's just something about the human experience that relates to that, you know, in-person connection, even though we technically were not in person. But it mimicked it really well.
Were the wheels starting to spin amongst your students thinking about, okay, this is in a classroom, what could we do with this elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They, you know, right away, you know, I proposed the idea, well, what about taking an entire semester long class where we're meeting every week in virtual reality? And they all said yes, they would absolutely. Mm-hmm. And several of them had big doubts, you know, going into this, you know, experiment, that it would be really, it would be very fake feeling. But they liked it. I know several of the students talked about the idea. One of them, his family lives on the coast, on the East Coast, and the idea of having family dinner, you know, that would be a way to kind of have this family connection, that they could all have their headsets on, they could all be eating, and, you know, they'd be in their own separate places, but they'd have this family connection that didn't exist. And I have to admit, I was really touched by that. I didn't think about something as simple as a family dinner could be recreated across the world and have this, you know, in-person experience for a few minutes each day. And I didn't even think about the value to something like that. So obviously the business world looks at this, the whole idea of virtual meetings, you know, these are things that we need to explore more.
And as we've learned with, everything, internet, social media, mm-hmm. computers, the ways people will end up using them is going to surprise us from our vantage point now.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, when we do this class again in the spring, you know, we're going to take this and push it even further and see what other and a lot of it is driven by the students. You know, the students are coming up with ideas of saying, hey, can we try this in a VR setting? So I really want to work with this next group of students and see how we can kind of take it from, you know, me doing a traditional classroom lecture to a much more interactive experience that really takes advantage of this, you know, three-dimensional interaction.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
That's Steve Knoll, professor of marketing at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about a virtual reality course he taught that just wrapped up its first semester at Madison College. You can share your thoughts and maybe experiences if you've used some of these virtual reality equipment things, maybe for fun, maybe in your workplace, maybe in an educational setting. Do you see some value in it? Is there something you'd like to give a try? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Watch us on Central Time on VR. Now you can't. If you want to live your life surrounded by cheese, you have two options. You can just live here in Wisconsin, or you can check out a new cheese-themed hotel opening later this month in London, England. As reported at Mental Floss, here are the specs for the cheese suite at Café Rouge. Cheese wallpaper? Check. Cheese bedding? Check. And I think that means normal sheets with cheese designs, not bedding made of cheese. Moving on, cheese art installations, they got it, plus some cheese-themed board games and cheese-scented soaps. There'll be crackers and cheese on hand, of course, in your room when you check in. And if you call room service, can you get more cheese? Oh, yeah. There is a contest to stay there one night for free, but sorry, it's only for UK residents. Yeah. Once again, why is London beating us to the punch on this one? They had the infinite conveyor belt cheese restaurant I talked about. I think it was last year sometime. Now they've got the cheese hotel. I think there's room in Wisconsin for cheese-themed motels and hotels. Maybe they exist. I don't know. Tell me about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or maybe you've decorated your very own room with a cheese theme. Why not? This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.